Bomb brown people. Not because they're trying to cut in on our action, just because they're brown. Now, you probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. Zero. Nope. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them, I don't really believe in my country, and I gotta tell you folks, I don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded. Now, to balance the scale, I'd like to talk about some things that bring us together. Things that point out our similarities instead of our differences. Because that's all you ever hear about in this country is our differences. That's all the media and the politicians are ever talking about, the things that separate us, things that make us different from one another. That's the way the ruling class operates in any society. They try to divide the rest of the people. They keep the lower and the middle classes fighting with each other so that they, the rich, can run off with all the money. Fairly simple thing happens to work. You know, anything different, that's what they're going to talk about. Race, religion, ethnic and national background, jobs, income, education, social status, sexuality, anything you can do, keep us fighting with each other so that they can keep going to the bank. You know how I describe the economic and social classes in this country? The upper class keeps all of the money, pays none of the taxes. The middle class pays all of the taxes, does all of the work. The poor are there just to scare the middle class. Keep them showing up at those jobs.
We'll be right back. And a lot of these issues, and you bring up a good point, the more progressive or traditionally democratic positions are often very popular. I mean, most Americans say the healthcare system is in bad shape on issues like abortion and guns and LGBTQ rights, gay marriage. Just there's a laundry list of issues where the Americans are pretty supportive. Yet the Republicans, with a minority position, even on abortion, most Republicans don't even have the same position as the party leadership. They kind of win. Like how does this happen, where you have these large movements with significant, even on immigrant rights, significant public support, but the Democrats just kind of get steamrolled?
Well, the poll results are very striking. Turns out that people don't know that the Democratic programs are the kinds that they support. So there are a lot of polls showing that take on Biden's Build Back Better proposal, you know, the main proposals. Turned out that on issue after issue, public strongly supported them, but they opposed the program. And when asked, turned out most people didn't know what was in the program. All they knew was this right-wing propaganda about how big government is coming to try to take your house away and hand everything over to the blacks and so on and so forth. We don't want that. A majority of Republicans, I think it's maybe two-thirds or so, believe in the great replacement theory. You know, the Democrats are conspiring to bring people in to destroy the white race. No, I'm not going to let that happen. So I don't know what's all this legalese and technical stuff in the program. I don't know anything about that. I just want to protect myself and my family. Now, that's great propaganda. Now, if you had a lively, active, militant working class, like in the 30s, they'd be educating people about, and organizing them about what's happening. They defend themselves. I can remember this very well. I'm old enough to remember the 1930s. My family was first-generation immigrants, working class, very active. They didn't have much formal education, but very educated, knew all about social and political issues, many other things. Deeply involved. Republican propaganda couldn't make any headway with them because they were parts of organized activist movements which were doing things as well as educating. If you don't have any self-defense mechanism, people are just alone, you know, atomized. They can't react.
I have a question, but then I have a question actually in response to that. Do you today, you know, we're seeing what seems to be a lot of energy around labor, talking about Starbucks and Amazon campaigns. Last October, they were talking about Striketober. But as we're, you know, as we see this like greater gaps in the between the haves and the have-nots, do you see this sort of like rising energy around labor and around other issues, climate, migrant rights, et cetera? Potentially being able to sway or influence the, I think the Republicans are lost, but sway or influence the Democrats going forward?
Potentially is the right word. It's possible, but take a look at those strikes. I mean, management now has developed very sophisticated tools to crush any kind of labor movement. You watch the tactics that are being used by Starbucks and Amazon to try to crush anything. And there's no restrictions because the labor laws have been dissolved, basically. Technically, there's some things on the books, but nobody applies them. And our National Labor Relations Board has been basically eliminated. There's no defense from government, from the political sector. There's no organized political parties. You go back to the 1930s, not only was there a militant labor movement, but there were a lot of activist political parties, political organizations. Now it's very different. The success in atomizing, intimidating the population has been pretty impressive. Now the Sanders movement is beginning to break with that, but it's very hard. And you can see it on issue after issue. Take today, for example, in Brazil, there's a very important election coming up with a social democratic candidate, Lula, who's way ahead in the polls, and neo-fascist Bolsonaro, who's strongly supported by the business world, the military, the police, and so on. Bolsonaro has said he's just not going to accept the election. He's going to follow the Trump line, probably with the same advisors coming from Trump's advisors. Well, Sanders tried to get a bipartisan Senate resolution saying the United States opposes a military coup, wants to have democratic elections. It's a very important election, most important country in Latin America. Couldn't get a single Republican to say we're opposed to a coup. Even something like that, you know, we're opposed to a military coup in a major democracy in Latin America. Not one. I mean, these people are just rigid proto-fascists, use the word.
You're listening to the Green and Red podcast. We are here, as I'm sure you figured out, with Professor Noam Chomsky. We're talking about the 50th kind of anniversary of the McGovern debacle and the evolution of American politics to the far right since then. And I think Scott has a question about a very important issue that's going on today within Democratic circles, which is where the priorities for the party and for the movement, for the larger progressive movement, should be.
Yeah. My other question, and this actually goes at least as far back as the McGovern campaign, but you know, why do you think Democrats have abandoned class material issues for issues around identity, around intersectionality, et cetera?
Well, suppose you're a Democratic representative. You get elected to the House, let's say. Now, what's the first thing you do? The first thing you do is get on the telephone to call the donors to make sure that they'll fund you in the next election. Because elections are pretty much bought in the United States. You look at Congress, there's very good work by Tom Ferguson, the political economist, and his associates. And the correlation between funding and electability is astonishing. You rarely get results like that in the social sciences. It's almost a straight line. So the first thing you do is get on the phone, call the donors, make sure they're happy. While you're doing that, a horde of corporate lawyers are descending on your offices to meet with the staff and to overwhelm them with all kinds of information, distortion, basically write the legislation. And then the congressman goes back and signs the legislation. It's not a caricature. It's pretty much, it's an exaggeration, but not much. Well, corporate lobbying exploded in the 1970s. Huge increase. The business world really saw the opportunity. We're not going to let it go to waste. Huge campaign spending, lobbying, every possible device to ensure that the Democratic elections can't really take place and that the business world could overcome this crisis of democracy. Elites were really frightened by the activism of the 60s. It's worth remembering then. The activism of the 60s really civilized the society. It's a very different country than what it was. I mean, things that used to be perfectly normal then are intolerable now. Elite opinion didn't like this. It's threatening. It's threatening to the basis of power. So you have to beat it back. You get on the right things like the Powell Memorandum, let's just go for the jugular. On the left, so-called, you get the softer ideas of let's have better indoctrination of the young and so on. But it's and then it was backed by enormous wealth and power. It would take some integrity and honesty to combat that. McGovern, as an individual, had it. But when he was crushed, it was a sign, no use trying, you know. Let's just go with the flow. And that's pretty much what happened. As there were some holdouts, like Humphrey and Hawkins, as I mentioned, didn't try to hold the traditional pro-labor position, but they were just wiped down.
Just a sort of change the topic, Professor Chomsky. I remember back in 1994 when the Republicans came in and part of Newt Gingrich's attack line on the Clintons were that they were cultural McGovernicks, and which implied that they were, you know, doves or peacenicks as far as like foreign policy. But we saw some very brutal foreign policy moves by the Clinton administration around Iraq, around the former Yugoslavia, and then, you know, that the sort of democratic hawkishness I know goes back, you know, decades, but particularly looking at Clinton and Obama, you know, how is this sort of democratic hawkishness abroad very much part of that the program of the corporate Democrats?
Yeah, I think that's very significant. And one thing about Gingrich is he switched the character of the Republican Party. He made it very clear, and he won, that the Republican Party should be at war. It should no longer try to cooperate in a parliamentary system the way it had before. It should just basically declare war. We're going to fight and destroy any opposition. We're going to take power. Gingrich is the one who changed the Republican Party in that respect. It's gone on from there. With regard to foreign policy, Clinton had an awful record. I mean, just take a look at U.S. funding. I mean, the U.S. foreign aid. The highest foreign aid went to the worst murderous human rights violators. And put aside Israel and Egypt, they're a separate category. But the rest of the foreign aid, the top foreign aid recipient became Turkey. Why? Turkey was carrying out a murderous campaign of state terror against its Kurdish population. Tens of thousands of killed, hundreds of thousands of refugees, thousands of towns and villages destroyed, and every kind of torture. Funding from Clinton increased as the atrocities increased. And finally, by the peak of the atrocities, 1998, Clinton U.S. aid to Turkey was greater than the entire Cold War period up to the launch of the counterinsurgency. Well, this was barely reported. New York Times has a bureau, of course, in Ankara, not a word about it, almost nothing. But take the sanctions against Iraq. Sanctions against Iraq were murderous. The two international diplomats, highly respected, who were administering it, resigned in protest, one after the other, because they said they're genocidal. Gave a lot of details about it. The second one, Hans von Sponeck, wrote a major book about it, Different Kind of War, describing the details about how the Clinton programs were devastating the civilian society and strengthening the dictator. You can't even mention the book in the United States. I doubt that there's been a review of it. This is just the beginning. It goes on and on. Meanwhile, you read the liberal press, say the New York Review of Books. It was describing Clinton's policy, I'm quoting now, as having a saintly glow, literally, as just something we've never seen before. Well, that's the left liberal press. What are people going to think? They don't read what's going on. Can't. Press isn't covering. If you look at the effects of NAFTA, one effect was to greatly increase the opportunities for the corporate sector to crush strikes illegally. So there's a study of the effect of NAFTA on labor actions by Kate, forgotten her name, Cornell University labor historian. Is under NAFTA rules, she undertook the study. Turned out that about, 50% or so of labor actions were simply killed by illegal corporate efforts related to NAFTA, like putting a banner up on the company headquarters saying the Mexico transfer operation. In other words, if you try to strike, you're going to move to Mexico. Not that they were going to do it, but it was enough to break the strike. It's illegal, but when you have a criminal state, it doesn't matter if it's illegal. A huge number of labor, I think about 50%, were undermined by this. Well, this is one consequence of labor, but it was a saintly glow, and so on and so forth. It's that's what you're fighting, a major propaganda system which manages to suppress almost everything that's happening. People are left in the dark. They know that things are no good, like they don't like the fact that they go bankrupt if they have a health problem. Doesn't happen in other countries. They know they lost their job and their town is destroyed because industry left and young people are leaving, but they don't know why. Even things like what I mentioned, the Build Back Better polls, people like every part of it, but hate the bill. And interestingly, Democrats didn't exploit that. They didn't say, okay, let's have a vote on piece by piece. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that. They just didn't cahoots with the ruling powers.
You're talking about foreign policy. You know, the other day I was teasing you that you and John Mearsheimer are responsible for everything that's gone wrong in Europe. But there has been this really kind of, the Democrats have really circled the wagons, the NATO liberals, and, you know, Scott and I have both been told we're pro-Putin and we're apologists. This isn't terribly surprising, but there's clearly the Democrats are behind the American support in Ukraine far more actually than the GOP is. And where does this head? I mean, doesn't this kind of make things worse for progressive politics?
It's worse than progressive politics. I think it's extremely dangerous for the world. I mean, we now have a situation where practically the whole world has been calling for negotiations. The whole global South, even Europe, Germany, for example, about 3/4 of the population want to go for negotiations. U.S. is blocking it. Nothing gets reported much, but can find out a little. So last April, this again, according to Fiona Hill in Foreign Affairs, pretty respectable, reports that in April there were negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, which were making some progress. And Hill says, well, of course, they were blocked by the Russians. Doesn't give any evidence. But what she doesn't report is that the Prime Minister of Britain, Boris Johnson, immediately flew to Ukraine with the message that the West, meaning the US and Britain, wouldn't accept it, followed by Lloyd Austin, defense secretary in the United States, who came with his message that said the point of the war is to weaken Russia, no negotiations. So, of course, they collapsed. Is there anything beyond? Does anybody know about that? Well, of course not. If you read antiwar.com, you can find out about it. Free country. But it's, and this is just, the most important thing right now, and I'm astonished that it's not being reported, is what the U.S. is doing in Taiwan. The Pelosi visit did get some publicity, but Congress, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, just passed overwhelmingly bipartisan what's called the Taiwan Policy Act a week ago. It's a pretty shocking act. It's now going to Congress. It calls basically turning Taiwan into what they call a non-NATO ally, but treating it like a NATO power, pouring weapons in, interoperability of weapon systems with the United States, joint military programs, treating Taiwan as having the same diplomatic status as an independent country. There is something called international law. We don't believe in it here, but it's out there somewhere. Unambiguously, Taiwan is part of China. It's like saying China saying they're going to have operations with Kansas or something like that. You go to free countries like Australia screaming about this. Actually, the U.S. has held to what's called a one China policy since 1979, recognizing that Taiwan is part of China, but then adding what's called strategic ambiguity. China and we agree not to rock the boat. In other words, not to talk about it, not rock the boat. It's as if Congress wants to have two major wars, each of which will destroy us. It's hard to figure out what can be going on in the minds of these lunatics. And of course, it doesn't get reported here.
Well, Taiwan is interesting because there's, like you said, there's really no ambiguity there. Pelosi knew what she was doing and they knew, how China would respond. So given the state of the world right now, pandemic and global economic crises, Europe especially, just everything's going wrong. Why would you, a war in Ukraine, a big war in Ukraine, where a lot of people have already died and it's crushing the global economy, why would you provoke China over Taiwan at this particular point? I don't get it. I don't understand it.
It's unbelievable. It's almost as if they have a death instinct. Let's get it over with fast. Let's have two major wars, each of which will destroy us. Now, somebody watching this from outer space, they think they're insane.
I have this image of the final scene from Dr. Strangelove, where the cowboy hat on the bomb, that's kind of where we're headed.
Yeah. Well, actually, Dan Ellsberg, who's an old friend, who was on the inside then, told me that when he and his friends from Rand Corporation went to see Dr. Strangelove, they could recognize everything. He said it's pretty much like what was going on there. They could even identify the people.
I think Scott had a follow-up on that.
Yeah, just that this is my final question. I've read your recent book with Vijay Prashad, The Withdrawal, and it's, this failed bipartisan foreign policy of the last 20 or 30 years, and also looking at, Ukraine and Taiwan. What does this reveal? What does this reveal about the U.S. supremacy in world affairs? Like, where it seems like we're in this sort of decline period. Lots of people say that, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
It's decline in some respects, but not in others. And I think what you're pointing to is the major issue in world affairs. Is there going to be a unipolar world with the U.S. running it, or is it going to be a multipolar world with a variety of power centers which just have to accommodate with each other? There's one thing we should not forget. Unless the great powers are able to accommodate and work together, we're done. The crises we face are all international. They don't have any borders. We're going to either work together or just collapse together. And now NATO, which is, of course, the U.S. instrument for global domination, has now officially expanded to the Indo-Pacific region. The last NATO summit expanded the North Atlantic to the Indo-Pacific region, meaning basically the whole world. I mean, it's not a secret, you know. It's completely public. Meanwhile, the world is opposing that. And it's pretty striking to see the way, you know, to see the way it's handled. I mean, I'm used to deceit and deception and so on, but sometimes it's hard to grasp. Like if you're reading the papers here, or even the foreign policy, for example, the policy journals, very excited about the fact that India is finally breaking with Russia and joining with the United States. And take a look at it. It's based on six words that Prime Minister Modi said at a meeting with Putin in Samarkand. He said, "This is not a time for war." Okay, that's it. I took the trouble of looking up his speech on the Indian government website. It's practically a love poem to Putin. He says, "This is not a time for war. We have to work together for peace. We have a wonderful record of cooperation. We're deepening it. We're looking forward to even warmer relations in the future." That's the speech. Comes out, India's breaking with Russia. I mean, current issue of foreign policy, foreign affairs just repeats it. I mean, you don't know what to say, you know.
Well, as always, we appreciate you talking with us on Green and Red. You're a favorite guest. I have one final question to kind of wrap all this up. It was great talking about McGovern and the Democrats from someone who was kind of present at the creation of that era. About, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago or so, I think it was during the second Bush administration, I was just saying, like, have you seen things this bad before? You know, and you said, well, this isn't as bad as McCarthyism. I'm not even close, I think. But it's, what, like 15 years later, and we've just gone through Trump. We still are enduring Donald Trump, a president who apparently steals documents, right? Would you still say this is like, you know, there's kind of hope out there and we're still kind of making some progress? Or is it like, you know, are we now at a place where we're back into, you know, 1948?
A lot of things are much better. If you go back and think about what the country was like in the 1960s, let's say, there's been enormous improvement. I mean, remember let's just take the Vietnam War, the worst atrocity, the worst crime since the Second World War. I'm not telling you don't know anything better than I do, but Kennedy sharply escalated the war, authorized the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam, initiated chemical warfare programs, crop destruction programs to drive huge numbers of people out of the villages into what amounted to concentration camps, authorized napalm. Couldn't get any interest, none. I mean, I remember I would talk to people in their living rooms. I'd go to a church where there's four people. Nobody gave a damn. Nothing. It was years. I was living in Boston, the most liberal city in the country. It was years before you could even get people to be willing to talk about it. not in the Cambridge elite sector. They never want to hear about it. But you get some popular opposition by the time the country is almost destroyed. Well, it's better than that now. Things, in fact, U.S. administrations know they cannot fight that kind of war again. In fact, one of the things that happened in Vietnam was that the army collapsed to its credit. Soldiers just refused to follow orders. The United States learned a lesson that every other imperial power had known for centuries. You can't fight a brutal, vicious colonial war with kids you take off the streets. You need professional killers. That's why you had the French Foreign Legion, you know, the Gurkhas and so on. That's now the U.S. fights war now with mercenaries called contractors or else at a distance, drones, you know. But no, just picking up kids across on the street and say, go out and murder people. Well, that's an improvement. There are a lot of changes like that. Not all to the good by any means, but a basis for moving on. It's what we can hope for.
Well, I'm glad you invoked Vietnam. That's always, I always like hearing that. Because I've put a challenge out to Oliver Stone to debate him. I'll give him $100, but he hasn't responded yet. So, and I was very still honored to be called Noam Chomsky's useful idiot on that issue. So we really appreciate this immeasurably. Can't wait to hear what you have to say about what's going on right now in Brazil. Maybe later in the future, we can talk to you about that. But this is great. It's a great history lesson, and we appreciate it immensely. And Scott has a few last words. So,
yeah, much appreciation for coming on, Professor Chomsky. Folks, you're listening to Professor Noam Chomsky on the Green and Red podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or our Patreon, patreon.com/GreenRedPodcast. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
One more word. point in life is called perspective.